so many adults whose job was, you know, working in an office or something, would tell me when I was a teenager, well, you need a lot of luck and all this, as if they know what the fuck they're on about, because like, that's, this isn't their job, they don't know this industry. Yeah, I just kind of stopped looking at it like that. I was like, no, I'm not gonna, it's not actually about luck. You know, there is an element of luck there, but the harder you work at this, the less that, you don't need to hang everything on maybe one day someone will turn to me and go, do you wanna write a film?
Hello, that was the voice of the comedian James Acaster, and this is In Writing with Hattie Crissell. That's me. James Acaster is a very busy man. You'll have seen him on TV a lot. He co-hosts Hypothetical with Josh Widdicombe, and he's often a guest on shows like The Last Leg and QI. He also hosts two podcasts, Perfect Sounds and Off Menu, and he's written two books. The first was 2017's hilarious James Acaster's classic Scrapes, and the second was 2019's slightly more serious but still very funny Perfect Sounds Whatever. That second book is a bit of a hybrid. It's largely James setting out his argument for why 2016 was the best year for music ever, with a breakdown of all the albums that made it so. But woven through that is a memoir of one of the most difficult years in his own life. Today, though, we have focused on something else entirely, James's approach to writing stand-up. I've always wanted to have a stand-up comic on the podcast. I think it's such an interesting form of writing, and James is very well placed to talk about it. He was nominated for Best Comedy Show at the Edinburgh Fringe for a record-breaking 5 consecutive years from 2012 to 2016. He then put together 3-hour-long sets that worked alongside each other, toured them simultaneously for a year, and ultimately filmed them for the Netflix series Repertoire, which I would highly recommend. James is brilliant on the practical details of writing stand-up. And actually, these days, very little of his is written down, but the principles of writing and the meticulousness of language is still very much there. He talks about the arc of a stand-up set and what a good callback should do. So that would be when you come back to a joke more than once through a set. And he's really interesting on trying to reconcile his natural tendency for self-criticism with the highly stressful on-stage dynamic of stand-up. It's a puzzle that he's been trying to work out during the pandemic while he hasn't been performing live. And I think, although we're not all in exactly James's shoes, a lot of us can relate to the last year having changed our perspective on work. I spoke to him earlier this month and I found the conversation fascinating. So here it is. Where are you as you record this? Are you in the room where you would write, or are you in some sort of special podcasting room?
I'm in my living room. I write in here, but not stand up. I don't have a room. I guess the room that I write stand-up in is, on stage and on the train on the way home.
Really?
Or on the train on the way to the gig. Yeah, yeah. So, well, yeah.
Even if you're writing a full set from scratch kind of thing, there's no sort of sitting at a desk involved.
There used to be. So I used to sit, and I used to really... quite romantic, you know, had a romantic relationship with that kind of stuff. I thought, oh, it's great. You got your notebook as a stand-up, and, you know, I used to love buying notebooks, and I'd sit down and write all the time, and I'd be, you know, most of my life as a open mic stand-up before I was making a living out of it is just travelling constantly, because I lived in Kettering, I didn't live in London, so I was travelling to London, or I was travelling around the country, and I was on trains all the time with my notebook, and I'd really make a big deal of it on the train that I was writing, and so that everyone could see I was writing on the train. And I'd, you know, sometimes I'd sit on the table where it's like, you know, there's 4 people on the table, and I'd like, you know, if there was an empty one, I'd be right on there and hope that other people sat down and asked me what I was writing. I could tell them I was a stand-up comedian, even though it wasn't officially my job. So really, I worked in a kitchen. But like, I used to love that. And then when I started writing like full-length shows, like my first full-length show was, you know, like any other comedian, is everything you've done so far. So it was whatever, 2.5 years, 3 years work. So I didn't really sit down and write it. It was more sitting out, figuring out the structure of all those bits that I've written. And the second show was the first time And the second show that I ever did, which was in 2012, was probably the most satisfying sitting down and writing comedy experience that I've ever had. Like, actually sitting down every day in my... I lived in a house share with three different people at the time. And I would sit down every day and physically write. And for whatever reason, I think because, you know, my first show in Edinburgh had gone well, numbers-wise and stuff, but, you know, reviews-wise or awards-wise hadn't made any noise. So I knew that there wasn't anyone anticipating me the following year. Maybe some audiences had been to see me, but, like, there was no expectations on me. So my only aim was, what were all the things I didn't like about my first show? And let's sit down and improve it for this second show. And so I could kind of, without any pressure and with, you know, the only thing that could have happened was positive things. I couldn't have, you know, messed it up more by working harder. So I sat down and wrote every day. And that was great. And that felt like, not effortless, but it felt like I had faith that I would discover something every day. And then it was the following year where I worked. I was really stressed about writing a good show, and I tried to sit down and write every day, and it completely destroyed me. I just lost confidence in myself as a writer, as a comic, and I produced a show that I didn't enjoy, and I didn't enjoy performing. And so after that, I just never sat down and wrote out anything again.
Because it was sort of too much pressure.
Pressure that I'd put on myself, yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, no one else was thinking, oh, what's James Acaster going to do this year? No one was thinking that. But I, in my head, was like, oh, you know, last year's Edinburgh went well, so now you've got to... Everyone's going to be thinking, oh, is it as good as last year's show? And I was trying to recreate what I'd done the previous year in terms of my writing regime and stuff like that. And I think... definitely what I've learned in terms of stand-up and writing stand-up is to approach each project differently. Don't try and recreate the last thing you did, because that's artificial. And I never sat down with that second show and went, right, I know what the routines are going to be. I know what each... the shape of the show. I didn't know any of that at the start. I just started writing things that were interesting to me or things that were funny to me. And then as I progressed with writing it, I discovered that, oh, these are all kind of like, I'm really enjoying rinsing everything out of each topic. And I'm really enjoying doing that until I find a satisfying punchline and having the confidence that there's a good enough punchline there. And so that second show, I ended up with a bunch of, you know, close to 10-minute routines that all ended in something that would either be a big laugh or on a good night and applause. And that was like, that became the show. But I didn't sit down going like, I'm going to write those sorts of routines. And then the problem with the third show was that I sat down and went, right, they each have to be 10-minute routines that rinse everything out of a subject and I have to end on an applause break. And actually, where my head was, I was better at writing short jokes all of a sudden for that show. And all my best jokes for my third show were the short ones. And looking back, it was because my brain had been writing really long stuff for a year and actually just wanted a break from that and wanted to have fun and write some short stuff. But I didn't let it because I thought, I've got to do something that's, you know, that's my thing now, is doing these long routines. I've got to do that. And sitting down and staring at my laptop became a very stressful thing that I didn't want to do anymore. And so the following show I did, my fourth show, the rule was just don't do any of that. Don't write any of it down. And if it's good enough, you'll remember it.
Don't write any of it down.
Yeah, yeah.
My God.
So I'd kind of write bullet points of, you know, like in my phone of the names of the routines. But I wasn't writing down the routines verbatim or anything like that. And I think the reason is because even when I had that show that I enjoyed writing, writing stuff down and stuff being funny on the page is very different to saying stuff out loud and it working and it being funny. And a lot of the time, if I wrote down a routine verbatim of, you know, something that read as funny, and then I went on stage and tried to say it like it was on the page, word for word, then it just didn't work. And you just felt like you weren't communicating with the audience who were in the room, because you felt like you were a robot who had memorized some lines and was just saying the lines.
So the sort of energy of it wasn't there.
Yeah, the energy wasn't there, and the audience didn't feel like they were being spoken to. And with stand-up, you know, it's not like a play where there's the fourth wall up and you can just sit and watch it, or a film. Like, with stand-up, even if it is scripted, the audience need to feel like you're communicating with them and that you're actually... because otherwise you can't really make them laugh. And so if I wrote it down and tried to stick to the script, it kind of lost that. Whereas if I had in my head, you know, you're doing this routine about oven gloves, and the joke is that you hate the oven gloves that link up in the middle, and kind of like just going on and trying to communicate that to them. And then you would, over time, either on stage or on the train, when you're thinking about, because I think about it a lot, I wouldn't sit down. I think staring at a screen would give me some paralysis. But if I was enjoying the exercise of thinking about the routine that I did that night, why didn't it work? Why did it work? And then I might come up with little key phrases that, oh, that might be funny. Say that next time. And then if a certain phrase really works and is clearly the right phrase for that routine, then I would write it in my phone after the gig and be like, okay, you said that the bit in between the oven gloves is like a quilted germ blanket. Write that in. And then, you know, always say that. And then you've got your beats that you jump between. But marrying myself to, like, word for word the same every night, I just found was always a problem, and would kind of mean that the routine would get worse over time instead of better.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I think it's just, you know, for me as somebody who is crap at public speaking of any kind and finds it completely terrifying, the thought of getting up on stage and going blank is what would really frighten me about that, and not being able to do the kind of off the cuff spiel. I mean, I know you've been doing it for a long time, so you probably don't have to worry about that now. But did you ever worry about that?
At the beginning, I kind of wouldn't. My favourite comics were people like Ross Noble and Eddie Izzard, who came across like they were... Well, they did a lot. They both did a lot of improvising, even though they did... They both do more writing than I think we're all aware of. But they did a lot of improv, and I wanted to do that. And so when I was an open spot, I would just think of some subjects the night before that I wanted to talk about and kind of formulate it in my head and not write it down. And then I'd do it on stage the next day. And that went well for a while because I wasn't really trying to be a stand-up. I was just doing it for fun. But when I decided I was going to make a go of it and try and be a stand-up comedian, it's that way of doing things started going quite badly. And even though I had all these subjects I wanted to talk about, I wasn't getting laughs all of a sudden, maybe because I was a bit stiffer, because it meant more to me. So I was a bit tenser suddenly going on stage because I had more to lose or whatever. And then it would be like a long time of me talking around a subject and getting nothing, and trying to find something funny in it in front of a silent audience is way harder than trying to find something funny in it in front of a laughing audience. And then I started being like, okay, I've got to start writing now, because not that I worried that I would go blank and not talk, it was just like I was worried about the opposite, almost, that the audience would be blank,
right?
And I would be talking. Yeah, and so that was kind of like the embarrassing thing, was like, oh yeah, that it just felt embarrassing every time that happened. And so it was more that I started writing because I thought, I've got to have some stuff that definitely works. I can't just go up and roll the dice every night, a, because, you know, it could always go bad, but also I didn't feel like I was learning anything that way. You know, I didn't feel all the good open mic comics that I was seeing were the writers. And, you know, there were some open mic comedians who were just, you know, pure anarchists and would just light up a gig, or they would absolutely flatten a gig and make it really awkward for everybody, and they were just making stuff up on the spot, and they were, yeah, either everyone was like, you know, going nuts for it, or, you know, someone would literally get up and punch them in the face during the gig. I saw that a couple of times. And so those people seem like the geniuses of the open mic circuit, but none of them are doing stand-up anymore. And all the people who look like, oh, they're really going to go somewhere on the open mic circuit, were the people who were good writers. And you could just hear the, you know, I remember seeing Mike Wozniak, and he just like went from being a fellow open mic circuit comic to a headliner, just because of One Edinburgh Fringe, where he went up with his debut show, and everyone was like, this show's amazing, because he'd sat down and written it. And that was like, that was my kind of like, definitely first lesson in stop being lazy and start writing your stand-up properly, and start thinking about the phrases you use. And I mean, that was the main thing, actually. Structure I was kind of always okay at, but the phrasing of stuff and choosing the right words was something that I hadn't really paid any attention to until seeing someone like Mike Wozniak and being like, oh, he's, if he changed that word to something else, this routine wouldn't work. And realizing that that is a big part of this, of the comedy tool belt that you need, is to choose the right words each time. Because half the time, the funny idea you've got in your head is funny. You're just not communicating it to the audience because you're using pretty bog standard language, or language that's a bit too vague, and you're hoping that they just see what's funny about it the same way that you do. Whereas if you choose the exact right word that can't be misconstrued, yeah, they can't help but visualize the same thing that you're visualizing because you've described it to a T, then it works every night. And that was a huge lesson early on, to be like, if you want to stop the audience staring at you and you waffling on, nail down your language a bit more.
Yeah. I want to talk more about all this, but let's just go back a bit. So how old were you when you did your sort of first bit of stand-up, and how did that come about?
I was 21. I was, at the time, it's quite a long story, but like at the time I was in a band, and I'd had a car crash, and I got really like freaked out about dying, and I started doing a bunch of things on like a bucket list kind of thing. And one of the things I wanted to do was do more volunteer work, and I painted an old lady's kitchen. I did a really bad job of it. The volunteer people who organized it asked me if they could do anything for me in return. I said no, because I felt bad about the job I'd done. And they insisted, you know, is there something you'd like to do? So I said, you know, I just kind of like looked at my list of things to do before I die and said I'd like to try stand-up comedy, thinking that they couldn't organise that for me, which they confirmed they couldn't. And then about a week later, within a week, they phoned me and said, coincidentally, a man has come in and asked us to help him organise a stand-up comedy workshop, and we've put your name down for it, and it starts next week on Thursday.
That is quite the coincidence.
Yeah, it was pretty mad. And the workshop wasn't, you know, there would be a lot of people who have gone to stand-up comedy courses and stuff who might be picturing something different to what I actually did. But yeah, the thing I did was, it was me and two other guys attended this workshop, and one guy was leading it. And he was, you know, he just turned up with some beers every week, and he'd sit there and have the beers to himself and not share them, but that was fine. And he would literally just get us to get up and do stand-up each week. So it wasn't really that he'd give loads of... He'd done the open mic circuit and then stopped, you know, a couple of years before. So, like, it wasn't like he'd been a professional comedian or that he knew loads about it. I think he just... Yeah, he was living in Kettman and he wanted to do something, and he liked stand-up, but maybe he didn't want to start doing gigs again. So he was like, oh, a workshop would be good, and I'll try and do that. And I actually found it really helpful to just be told every week, because he would say, and you know, as a writer yourself, you might hear this and be like, this is an unreasonable request, but I didn't know at the time, so I wasn't a writer. But he would just say to us, write 10 minutes of new stuff every week, and you know, we'll give you feedback on it. And like, to a stand-up now, 10 minutes
that's
is like, well, that
quite a lot.
Yeah, that might take me a while to get a good 10 minutes. But at the time, all I ever saw of stand-up was, you know, DVDs and stuff, and they were over an hour long. So I was like, well, 10 minutes is nothing, you know, compared to what stand-ups have to write. I didn't know they were doing shorter sets elsewhere. So, yeah, we would write 10 minutes of new stuff a week. We'd have to turn up in the little activity centre or community centre that it was held in, perform it to the other three people, and they would just say that was good or that was bad. Then the next person would get up and you'd give them feedback, and that happened for 9 weeks. And then at the end of it, we did a gig in Kettering in a pub. Most of the audience knew it was our first ever gig. And we just went up and did 10 minutes each. Again, it was that thing of like not really understanding the writing. So I didn't really understand that we were kind of like doing our 10 minutes every week so that we'd eventually have a good 10 minutes out of all of that for the gig. I just thought, you know, we write new 10 minutes every time. So for the first gig, I just did another 10 minutes that I hadn't done in the workshops. And the audience were really behind us and encouraged us all, so it was fun. But I didn't think about becoming a stand-up. You know, I kind of, once every 4 months, I'd do a gig just for fun. Until, yeah, my band stopped. And then I was like, right, I'm going to try and do stand-up comedy now.
That workshop thing actually sounds amazing, because it's not, I mean, it's really similar to what they do on creative writing courses, where you have to workshop something every, you know, every week. And I think that is probably the quickest way to A, get confident about sharing material with people, and B, get really constructive feedback and get used to taking feedback. Do you remember any of the sort of jokes from that material that you were doing at the beginning? And also, do you feel like in style, was it pretty similar to what you are still doing now, or were you trying something different at the beginning?
I think I kind of, for a lot of the first few years, I was trying something different all the time, because I was really obsessed with finding my voice and finding who I was as a stand-up. At the beginning, when I didn't kind of care that much, I was just kind of trying to be like Ross Noble. So I was trying to be affable, and like, you know, like I was kind of fake laughing at everything I said as well. Like in real life, I don't walk around making jokes with my mates and then laughing at my own jokes. You know, I don't do that. And so I was really faking it on stage. So I felt like I have to act like I'm having a great time and that I really like them, because I need them to like me. So I have to be going on and going, hey guys, oh, you guys are crazy. And like, you know, and I make a joke and then laugh at my own joke or laugh halfway through it. Like, you know, I can't even get to the end of it. I think this is so funny. And all this kind of like I was this like scatterbrained kind of guy who just like would think of a new idea halfway through a sentence and go off on that, and thought that that's who everyone wanted to see on stage. And it took a while to kind of figure out that like that's not who I am, so maybe don't go on stage like that. And the more that I kind of got, I then went for a really heavily deadpan stage that was too deadpan and too pulled back for a while, but it really helped in terms of writing. That really helped with becoming a better writer, because I basically stripped myself of anything else. Like I had zero performance, you know, in my act. Like I'd got rid of all my performance skills, and I was now so far pulled back from them that in order to get them to come all the way to me, I needed to write better so that that would bridge the gap on its own. And that was a good exercise for a few years, just to do that. Although I hate watching footage of myself during that time now, because I just think, oh, make an effort, mate. You're speaking too quietly and committing too little to each routine and just letting the writing do all of the heavy lifting. And then after that, I really kind of worked on my performance and how to tackle each routine in a different way, and not just see it all as like, you know, you've got one comedy persona and that's it. It's more that you've got this comedy persona and it's got to be a three-dimensional person, and so you've got to have different elements to it and different strengths, and you can't just, you know, human beings don't go around being the same in every situation, and so you shouldn't as a stand-up either. But yeah, that early stuff, you know, writing wise, it was very, very whimsical, very pop culture-y. I remember I had a routine about Samuel L. Jackson wanting to be in Star Wars, and Bjork throwing throwing stuff off of a cliff every morning when she wakes up, because she sang that in one of her songs. It'll often be like stuff like, you know, because I'd seen an interview with Samuel L. Jackson saying that he would have played a stormtrooper in Star Wars. He just wanted to be in it. And so I did a whole routine about if Samuel L. Jackson was a stormtrooper in Star Wars. And I had a thing about, yeah, Bjork had that song where she says about throwing car parts, bottles and cutlery off of a cliff when she woke up every morning. And I did a routine about living with Bjork and how annoying that would be. and kind of like most of my routines were that, because I enjoyed watching stand-ups who would talk about obscure pop culture references, like little things that they'd seen somewhere in an interview or in a song, a lyric or whatever, and then going off on that and doing act outs for a long time. And so like that's kind of the stuff I was drawn to the most. And then also true stories that were like almost inconsequential anecdotes from my life. So I guess I started watching people like Russell Howard and stuff shortly after that. And so anything, any kind of small thing that had happened that was a funny turn of phrase or whatever that someone had said and stuff like that, I would want to kind of like go on and do those kind of short little anecdotes as well.
Right.
So that was mainly what I was doing at the beginning, was like kind of inconsequential whimsy and mainly doing that.
And so you said after you did that workshop, you then were just sort of doing it as an occasional thing for fun. So at what point did it become clear that comedy was what you were going to do for a living?
Just when I when my band stopped when I was 20 or 22, but then I started stand up. But yeah, when it stopped when I was 22, I was like, okay, I don't know what I'm going to do now. Because I didn't go to university because of wanting to be in a band. I didn't see the point of like going to uni, and I didn't even know what I would have studied there. Like I had no desire to study anything. And so I thought, there's no point going to uni and studying something that I don't even like to do a job that I inevitably won't like, when what I want to do is be a musician and be in a band. So I just didn't go. I didn't do my A-levels either, and I just formed a band with my friends and did that for ages. And when that stopped, I was like, oh, I don't have anything to fall back on. And also, I'm kind of exhausted from doing bands now, because, like, you know, I was the drummer, and I would do a lot of the, you know, I'd book a lot of the gigs and organise a lot of the band practices and stuff like that. And I just kind of felt, I don't want to start another band from scratch and have all that again. And I just thought I'd take a break. And the only thing I've been doing besides music was stand-up, you know, every now and again. And I thought, well, I really don't want to sit at home watching TV every night, even though nowadays, 36 years old, I absolutely love that. But back then, I would just was really restless, and I didn't want to just sit around doing nothing. And I only did stand-up because it was something that I could do, and I thought this will just fill the time until I figure out what it is that I want to do, either until I get the energy to form another band. Or there was a whole bunch of other stuff I was trying at that point. I tried to write a short film. I tried to direct a short film and edit it. The whole thing was like not a disaster, but it didn't work. I was trying to like do creative writing for a local fanzine, and you know, writing articles about like days out. I'd go for a day out somewhere and try and write an article about that and see if I was any good at, you know, creative writing. And so I was just trying out a whole bunch of different things, really, like cartoons. I'd always drawn as a kid, and like so around that time I bought myself like a professional kind of ink pen and was trying to get better at drawing cartoons. And again with that, I was like, you know, I could do a good first frame, but then when I had to repeat the character, I was shit at, you know, I couldn't make the character, you know, couldn't multiple times draw the same character and it always looked good, and that was frustrating. But stand-up, which wasn't even like something that I was sitting down and working on as much, I just found was much easier to get better at and to improve and to feel the improvement and to feel like I was solving the puzzle. Because I guess being forced to be up in front of people, you just have to get better. They're all watching you. You're not in your living room trying to draw a cartoon character, and there's distractions in the room, and there's your own voice in your head of telling you you probably can't do it again or whatever. Whereas being on stage in front of an audience, suddenly I've got to make them laugh. And I wouldn't hear the, you know, really the self-doubt as much. I mean, I think it was still there, but I wouldn't, it wouldn't distract me. And so I just found myself just getting better at it a bit easier. And it was only a year and a half in to doing it. So, like, you know, I've been doing it for quite a while when I thought to myself, oh, I actually want this to be my job. And I want to make a living out of it. And then 6 months later, Josie Long asked me to support her on tour. And I got to do that and quit my job. I was the classroom assistant at a school. And from then on, I've not had to do any other jobs. And that's been, stand-up's been my job since then. But yeah, there wasn't a, sometimes you talk to new comedians or, you know, young people who are interested in trying stand-up comedy. And they ask about, you know, how did you make it your job, or how did you, how much money do you make at the start and things like that. And obviously at the beginning you make no money, you make a loss. And I wasn't even trying to make it my job. I think my generation of comedians, my kind of school year, if you like, were the kind of the last ones who didn't see comedy as a potential career. We were just doing it because we were drawn to it for some reason. And I remember the wave of comics who came in after us, we would talk to them and get scared. It was like talking to some sort of business manager. It's like, okay, here's my 5-year plan. I'm going to do this gig and this gig. And it was like really like, they were really business minded. And our lot were just, yeah, a bunch of kind of like, you know, people who had tried and failed at other stuff, or, you know, we just wanted to do it and didn't know why. And because of our obsession with doing it, it wasn't like, yeah, we saw it as this will lead to something. It was just stand up in itself was the end game.
Yeah.
And getting good at it. And, you know, I'd talk to people like, you know, I used to stay around Joel Dommett's house a lot, and he was doing 3 gigs a night, going around London, just constantly gigging. And he wasn't talking about, this is how we get booked on the Apollo, James, or anything like that. he was just like, I'm trying to get better at stand up. Yeah. And we were just obsessed with it for reasons that we didn't really know. It was just fun to get better and to work hard at it. And I was really surprised when I got a phone call from Josie saying, do you want to support me on tour? So I was like, oh, wow. I'd already decided at that point I wanted to do it as my job, but I'd had no idea how I was going to do that. And I guess really you just do it through gig as much as you can, keep on improving, and the opportunities will come to you. Anyone who's, and I know you didn't ask this question, but I always just think that if anyone's listening to it and thinking about how to get into stand-up, I just think anyone who bombards agents with emails and tries to figure out how do I get an agent, just stop it. Stop trying to get an agent and just try and be a good comedian. Because what's great about comedy, stand-up comedy, as opposed to, you know, trying to be a writer, an author, an actor, a musician, is that you do just get rewarded for being good at it. Like, if you work hard and you're doing well at gigs, then people will come to you and want to sign you and want to.
You feel like it's a bit of a meritocracy then?
Yeah, it's just a bit less people are doing it than all those other industries I mentioned. There are loads of gigs, so, you know, there's enough room for everyone to be gigging all the time. And as long as you're focusing on getting better, you know, there's a lot of comics I know who really complain that they're not as big as they should be. And you see them do gigs, and sometimes you go, you are brilliant. And also, on top of that, this is your job. Like, you are making a living out of it. So your complaints, I'm not taking them seriously, because you're a professional comedian, you're gigging all the time, you are really good, and the reason why you're able to make a living out of it is because you're good. So you can complain that you're not bigger and not on TV and not famous, and that's a shame that you're complaining about that, but like, you are making a living out of it, and there are amazing musicians in the world who are not making a living out of it.
Yeah,
and it's more unfair. So, you know, And then there are comics who never make a living out of it. And you see them and go, oh, yeah, because you're not really trying. You're not very good because you've not worked on this. You know, you used to be good a few years ago and then you thought, that's enough. I don't have to do any more work. And you haven't progressed. And so now it's not your job. And it's a bit more cut and dry. I don't really often see comics and go, why the hell? You know, sometimes you see people and go, this person's amazing. I really wish they were more kind of like they were better known. But that's where it does become a bit more of a riddle. There's no real rhyme or reason to why certain comics are, you know, famous and in that regard and get, you know, and are better known by the public. But in terms of making a living and it becoming your job, it always makes sense, you know, who's all the people who are professional stand-up comedians. Even if they've only ever written one 20-minute set and never bothered writing anything else for 20 years, that 20 minutes is still really good, really well-written, and they can perform it really well, and they're getting paid for it. So,
yeah. You know. You do strike me as someone who is a relentless hard worker, though. I mean, when you were talking before about all the things that you tried at before you decided comedy was the one, you're obviously very, very creative, but also incredibly driven. Do you think that's fair to say?
Yeah, I used to lie to myself when I was a teenager that I was that person when I wasn't, because there was no one else around who was that creative. You know, I only knew the kids at my school, and so I was the one who was like, I played the drums and I drew cartoons and I was funny in the, you know, school drama class. And so, like, you know, I thought I was this big creative guy. And then when I was like 17 and left school, I met a bunch of people who were in a band outside of school, and they were older than me, and they practiced every day. I only ever practiced during actual band practice and at gigs, and I didn't do drum practice on my own in between. And then I met these guys, and I went round to hang out with them at their house, and they were all just in separate rooms practicing their instruments, and they already had a record deal and had released like EPs and stuff and done tours with bands that I liked. And I realized, oh, it's not just, you know, you can watch a lot of documentaries about, you know, musicians or whatever, and it all just seems like this fairy tale of luck and serendipity, and they just got their big break and it went well for them. But it's because it's really boring to, in the documentary, talk about all the practice that they did. So that people don't talk about that. And when I saw, especially the drummer of this band, who I thought was an amazing drummer, just practicing doing something that he couldn't do in his bedroom, and like messing it up and starting again and messing it up and starting again. And I was like, oh, I'm not going to become a professional musician if I don't do this. And from there, it's from that day, really. I was like, I have to practice every day. I've got to do stuff that I'm not good at and get better at it and learn to do it.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it's felt like a, not a superpower, but a secret weapon against all the other musicians that
work.
I knew who weren't. Yeah, I was like, oh, I can do this. And that will actually really improve my chances. Because everyone's trying to get into this industry, and I'm actually actively getting better at what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I just kind of formed this belief that maybe isn't true in music but ended up being true in comedy, of if I just work hard at this and focus on getting better, and getting better in terms of, you know, making the kind of thing I want to see, then yeah, this will pay off, and it's not a big chance of luck anymore. So many adults who, by the way, don't do anything creative, adults whose, you know, so many adults whose job was, you know, working in an office or something, would tell me when I was a teenager, well, you need a lot of luck and all this, as if they know what the fuck they're on about, because like this isn't their job, they don't know this industry. But they'll all tell you, well, you need so much luck to get into that, blah blah blah. And and then kind of like, yeah, I just kind of stopped looking at it like that. I was like, no, I'm not going to, it's not actually about luck. You know, there is an element of luck there, but the harder you work at this, the less that element of luck is everything. You're hanging everything. You know, you don't need to hang everything on maybe one day someone will turn to me and go, do you want to write a film? You know, and like, actually, if I actively try and get better at this and work hard at it, It's more fun and less frustrating. All the people who sit around saying, why aren't I doing better? Why are people not noticing me? Why haven't I got enough retweets today? Why isn't this happening? They're not working on it. So they're just angry all the time. And like, if you work hard at it and you fill your day with working on the thing, I've spent, you know, a whole day the other day trying to write a screenplay that will probably never get made. But that day was really fun. And I felt like I got better as a writer when I was doing it. And I felt like I enjoyed imagining the world that I was writing in my head. And the whole thing was enjoyable. And that's why I do this as a job, is because I enjoy being creative. And so if I stop trying to avoid that thing that I enjoy and I just get into it, then...
It's win-win. Then,
yeah, even if you fail. Like, even if you fail, it's a win, because you are just like, well, I enjoyed making the thing.
Yeah,
I enjoyed the exercise of getting better and what it taught me. Whereas every time I have done projects as well, where I've, you know, tried to avoid doing the work, it's just been something that takes up loads of your time anyway, because you've committed to it in some way. You hate doing it because you're trying to avoid it rather than engage with it. And then at the end, it fails. And so the whole thing is just unpleasant and makes you bitter and completely gets in the way of like every single reason that the, you know, teenage me wanted to do it in the first place.
I think in terms of comedy and hard work, that reminds me of Steve Martin's book, Born Standing Up. Have you read that?
Well, I haven't read the whole thing. I've been given... at one point, I had three different copies of it in the flat.
Why haven't you read the whole thing? I loved it. Did you get bored?
Well, no, everyone says it's brilliant, and I probably should read... when I was given it at the time, I don't think I wanted to hear what another stand-up had done to get somewhere.
No, fair enough. I didn't want to concentrate on your own thing.
Yeah. And I think I read the beginning, but I started reading it and there was things of him doing gigs and doing other comics material. And I was like, fuck this guy. and then just left it. But well, like, I should get back to it.
Well, I mean, that book really stuck with me. And I think because it opened up to me for the first time how much hard work is going on behind the scenes in stand-up comedy, because it is about that part of his career, not about his acting. But there's a bit in that where he talks about having a sort of, when he's on stage, having a kind of split experience where half of him was performing and half of him was listening very carefully to the reactions, and I think to the point of even making sort of mental notes about like, they laughed more when I landed on that word rather than throwing it away, or you know, they laugh more when I pause before I say that than they did last night when I didn't pause. Are you doing an element of that as well? How much sort of editing or kind of rewriting-ish is happening in the moment while you're performing?
Yeah, definitely. I definitely do that. And those exact thoughts, actually, just like, I mean, sometimes, you know, you think about that, again, off stage, way to the gig, like an hour before going on stage, I think is when I do my most amount of writing, and it is all in my head, but like, it is thinking, okay, you've got to go on stage in a minute, like, that's a reality. This routine keeps not working. Are you just going to say that routine again like you did when it didn't work, or are you going to do something about it? And kind of, and doing stuff like that, like thinking, and you get more of a ear for it over the years, and then more of an instinct where you can go, oh, do you know what? You're rushing that line, so put a pause in here. Or maybe the pause is what's hurting you, so take that pause out and go on and just get to that word, because the audience are getting there before you. And definitely on stage as well, kind of, not necessarily kind of like saying it, if I do it how I've always been doing it and it's not been working and I just do the same thing again and it gets the same kind of reaction, I don't think afterwards on stage, okay, maybe I'll try that differently tomorrow. I'll probably think that off stage and think, right, let's not do that again. But sometimes in the moment, when I'm doing a routine, it kind of just occurs to you before you say it, like, because you are, again, that thing of engaging with the audience, being in the moment with them. And sometimes, you know, going into a routine or going into a line and actually not feeling like you're just going through the motions and repeating what you did last night, you're really in the moment with them. And suddenly you just see it clearly of like, I need to slow down on this bit, or I need to do a pause there, or I need to deliver this bigger, or whatever it is suddenly occurs to you that, you know, this is more of a throwaway joke, stop selling it as much. And once you get that in the moment in front of the audience, you definitely, you come off and it is logged. Like, as soon as you try that new thing on stage, it's logged in your head. Sometimes I've been known to kind of like vocally, you know, my tour manager Paul will be in the room and I might even say on stage, Paul, can you write that down please and remember that I did that, because that will get it'll get a laugh from the audience that I'm being unprofessional. But like you know, I might think to myself, I might not, you know, if it's like the start of the first half, I think I might not remember that by the end of the night, so I'll just vocally ask Paul to write it down.
You don't do you ever record it and listen back?
I used to record them and I never listened back. I couldn't stand it. Like, I would listen back and just be like, well, I'm the worst comedian in the world, so why am I even sitting and trying to work on any of this? I hated the sound of my voice. I hated how I was delivering things. I felt all the stuff was boring. I just couldn't listen back. I can just about watch myself back now. But like, yeah, in terms of doing it in, to try and get, I can watch myself back once I've got it to a point where I like it, but when it's still a work in progress, I just can't stand it. I think I have to kind of like, I have to just figure that out all out on stage and in the moment and the way to and from the gig.
Stand-up sets tend to have an arc. How would you sort of explain the anatomy of a good stand-up set, if that's not too stupid a question?
No, it's not stupid. I think it's, I find it really interesting, and I found it really interesting when I was like getting ready to do a solo show. And I'd been doing their 20-minute sets, and I'd go to Edinburgh and watch someone do an hour. And Edinburgh's such an amazing place before you've done it. I mean, it's an amazing place anyway, but when you start doing hour-long shows, it becomes quite a stressful place, and a lot of us find it difficult. But like, before I did an hour-long show, I used to love so much watching comics do an hour that I probably couldn't see do an hour anywhere else. They weren't necessarily touring or anything like that. And the structures of their shows were interesting. Some people, it really is. I mean, so much of stand-up is that it has to suit you as a comedian. So there's no definitive answer to what's a good structure for a stand-up set, because every single element of your comedy, from the structure of the show, your delivery, the content of your jokes, the writing, the performance, like the persona, all of it has to be specific to you in order for it to be the best it can be. And it has to suit who you are. And, you know, first of all, there's like, I think the key to it all is coming up with an onstage persona that works, that is, you know, a kind of an alternate reality version of who you are in real life. And then you can build everything else around that. And for me, having a persona that was someone who overanalyzes tiny things in life, meant that the structure of the show being a little bit more considered made sense, that my onstage persona and who I am in real life would be wouldn't just do an hour of jokes without a structure and leave. But there are other comics who that's exactly what I want from them. Right. You know, I just want to see them do an hour of just material, and I don't need a structure, I don't need an arc. I just love that pureness of like just comedy, just seeing someone go up, do no frills stand up, and the material just speaks for itself, and that's it. But I don't think that would make much sense with my persona, and so I wouldn't necessarily go in and deliberately, I wouldn't come up with a structure from day one. I do just like go on stage and do a bunch of disconnected routines at first, and then I figure out as I go along what I want to do. And definitely I did do, you know, my first two shows were there was no arc. It was just a series of routines. And I was learning, you know, first show, I was just learning to be on stage for an hour. And second show, I was learning to write good material that was, you know, as watertight as I could make it. So it was just a series of blocky, big routines, but that didn't have a link. There wasn't, the link was my persona. And, you know, the fact that all of them were overanalyzing something small, but there wasn't a link between the routines. That's why they had to end on this crescendo, because then I could start again. Because there wasn't a link from that routine. There wasn't a line that went, and speaking of this, and then into that bit, it was literally that line has to be big enough for them to applaud or give a big laugh. And then I can reset it and put the ball back in the center spot and start again. And then the third show was when it was like, it was literally a show of the first half of it was short jokes that were not connected to each other. And the second half was this theme of trying to clear the name of Yoko Ono, but that had callbacks to all of the short jokes in the start of the show.
Right.
But that wasn't deliberate. It just happened that while I was writing that show and I was hating it, I needed to do something that would... because all I was writing was these short bits and I just needed a long bit. I just wanted something that would take up more of the time. And I think I'd seen some documentary where someone was once again criticising Yoko Ono for breaking up the Beatles. And I just thought, I'm sick of this. I'm sick of hearing it my whole life that she did all this stuff that was wrong. She didn't. And decided that that was a silly thing to get angry about. And then thought it'd be fun to, you know, just make the second half of the show just all about Yoko Ono. And then it just so happened that, you know, I guess, yeah, when you give yourself into the fun side of it a bit more, you just, more fun presents itself. And it was like, oh, here's an opportunity for a callback to this joke. And here's an opportunity for a callback to this one. And so, but it's still a messy show. And then all the shows after that, well, not all the shows after that, the next three shows after that, the structure became a much more deliberate part of things, because I thought the only thing I liked about that third show was that in the second half, I had this big thing that was stupid that I hung everything on, and it enabled me to do the material within that world. And it didn't feel like the audience were like, okay, we laughed at that joke and now we're back to zero again and you need to make us laugh again.
Yeah.
It felt like there was this overarching thing of, we're talking about Yoko and I'm getting passionate about it, so that they didn't see the joins as much between all the little routines. And I was able to just like build momentum more, and it was more of a fun world. And that was the only thing that I liked from that show. And I was like, well, I want to do that again.
I think the thing about callbacks is really interesting, actually, because just thinking about it now, like that is something that crops up in lots of different kinds of writing and entertainment, I guess. And even in journalism, often what journalists will do in a feature is that they'll plant some sort of idea near the beginning of the feature, and then they will call back to it in the final paragraph and try and wrap it up in a way that brings that together. And I mean, I'm just thinking about that from my point of view as a journalist, but obviously in comedy, that's often something that can build layers of laughter as you go through. And I wonder whether, I guess there's something particularly satisfying for people in hearing a reference back to an idea that is already somewhere in their, you know, somewhere in their mind. I don't know quite why that is such an effective thing.
I think that on a very basic level, and there's different ways of doing it, doing a callback, and there are really lazy ways of doing it that I've definitely done in the past as well, where you just literally repeat the thing that you said earlier. And it's not really for any particular reason, and you're kind of just repeating it in the same context and under the same lens, and you're just it's just literally showing people the same thing again. And that can get a laugh just because they saw it earlier, and so their head tells them to, that's familiar, laugh at it, and that's it. But it's kind of pretty empty and actually not that nourishing, and this go away with the illusion of structure, as Stuart Lee says. And I think a good callback presents the same thing in a different light, and the audience, because often you can see it coming when people just do a lazy one, like, oh, they're about to, because they're kind of talking along a certain theme, and it makes you go as an audience member, oh, that reminds me of that thing they said earlier, and
yeah,
then here it comes, and then you're like, right, okay. whereas I think being able to bring it back a lot of the time, if you're writing a show that I just find that when you have to write a show in a year, a stand-up show in a year to do it at the next Edinburgh, you just do naturally write material that does link up and has a lot of similar themes, because that's where you are in your life at the time. And natural opportunities for callbacks present themselves all the time, especially if you're like, you're trying out these routines in 20-minute sets, and you're going on stage at a club and doing these new routines, and you're trying them out in different orders every night, and so therefore you're doing different, you're trying to find different links between those routines, because you're going on, right, you're 20 minutes tonight, I want to do this, 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 and this, how am I going to go from this routine to this routine in front of this audience? And then you just do find the links between them, and then once you then build in an hour-long show, you have these opportunities for callbacks that aren't as obvious, that are like, oh yeah, because, you know, I found that the link between this routine and this routine is actually this emotional thing rather than the actual literal, day-to-day scenario that I'm talking about. And then therefore you can do a callback that can later become a callback when those routines are now quite far apart, and they're not next to each other in a 20-minute set, but they're quite far apart in an hour. And you realise you can do a callback to that first routine that the audience don't see coming, because you're just talking about how emotionally it's the same. And so you get to just compare it to it and just say, you know, it's like that, you know, it's like that thing that I talked about earlier. And people go, oh yeah, like, he's literally been talking about this routine. This routine he's doing now has been going on for 5 minutes. None of us thought that it connects to that thing earlier.
Yeah.
And they've just gone, magic trick, it's that. And then you're, oh, great. and that's more fun, I think. And like doing stuff where it's like a good twist in a film has to be one that they've been showing you the whole time, but you've not seen.
You haven't seen it coming. I think it does sort of add, it sort of seems to add value to the original joke as well. Like, somehow it's kind of, it's a bit like getting a, you know, bonus laugh out of something.
Yeah. But it has to make sense as we figure outable. As we figure outable. Because, like, it's like a good Shyamalan film, which is, there's one, but a good Shyamalan film is like the twist at the end, you go, oh, how did I not see that?
But
for
also,
the whole film,
my God.
Been,
yeah.
Because that's why it's, oh my God, because it's like, he's been showing it to you the whole film. He's been going, it's this, he's dead, everyone, he's clearly dead. And then at the end, they go, he's dead. And you go, how didn't I notice it? But then his other films, which the twists aren't as good, he just kind of goes, here's the twist. And you go, how could I have possibly known that? You've not been showing me that the whole film. The information hasn't been there. The twist relies on a bit of information that none of us knew, so it's not satisfying. It's the same as with callbacks. If it's too easy to figure out, it's bad. And if you try and hide it from them too much and then do the callback, it's like, well, that doesn't even make sense. You're just saying the thing you said earlier out of nowhere. Whereas it has to be something that all the logic is all inbuilt. It's all there. You could have figured it out if you wanted to, but you didn't because you got swept up in the show. And then the callback brings you back to that place. And then it feels exciting and fun.
Yeah. You wrote in Perfect Sound Whatever about being very hard on yourself, just by personality, being a very self-critical person. I thought that was really interesting because to an outsider, you are in a career which is so exposing. I mean, for most of us, it's kind of a worst nightmare scenario to be up there on the stage and in charge of making people laugh. You're in such a direct feedback loop with your audience. How do you square that with your tendency to be quite hard on yourself?
I'm still working on that, if I'm honest. Like, it's not something that I really have an answer to at the minute. It's something that I've only really... That book that you mentioned, I wrote it in 2018. So it was still something... And I was just figuring it out around that point. of kind of going, because only when I started going to therapy in 2017 did I kind of start thinking, oh yeah, I actually am really critical of myself. Whereas before that, I'd just seen that as something that I should be. I think I was so worried about becoming arrogant and how much I didn't like arrogant people that I just went completely the other way and was more self-critical and didn't see that as a problem, because I saw it as a good thing because I wasn't an arrogant wanker. And then when I kind of like started really struggling in 2017 with like mental health stuff, it was because I'd kind of done that to myself for years. And I started to realize, oh, that wasn't really very healthy, actually. So then you start looking at stand-up and going, oh yeah, and I'm on stage all the time, and maybe this is why I throw so many gigs. Like, you know, I'll be on stage, I'll feel like it's going bad, I'll feel like I'm rubbish, and so therefore I'll like turn on the gig, turn on the audience, start saying, you know, this gig's going shit, or, you know, or whatever, and then ruin the gig. And then you become aware of that, and then you think, oh, I'm aware of it now, so now I can control it. But it's such a visceral feeling in the moment of like that extreme humiliation or embarrassment, getting angry at yourself, not liking yourself, thinking this audience are going to remember this, and just how cringe it is in the moment as well. That like, yeah, you know, mess the gig up. So I'm not really, obviously now, you know, we're doing this interview now, you know, 2021, during the pandemic. I've had over a year now. I mean, the last gig I did was December 2019. So I haven't really had it, you know, when I wrote that book, that was 2018. Then I did a tour for a year of a really intense kind of personal show, and I found that quite hard, and was thinking about, you know, the things we just said about during that, and how do I combat this. And it was such a like intense tour that I didn't really have time to kind of really figure it out, and then I just haven't gigged since. So I mean, where I am now is that I kind of think I've been a lot happier not being on stage, so I'm not that inclined to try and figure out how I do it again.
Yeah.
And how I figure it out. Instead, I'm kind of trying to figure out, how do I not get on stage for a while? But then at the same time, you know, it worries me that I don't really have anything else that's like like massively, that's as reliable job wise as stand-up. You know, stand-up comedy, I can do it whenever I want. I can, you know, book a tour, and I'm lucky enough to have an audience at the moment. It's all just down to me to write it, get to the gig and perform it. I don't have to get it through TV execs or anything like that.
Yeah.
Everything else I try and do has gatekeepers in the way, and it's a lot harder to get off the ground. And so you think, well, I've got this really reliable thing here, stand-up comedy, and at the minute, my body is telling me not to do it, and I might have to do it at some point, and I don't know what to do.
Yeah, maybe you can work out a way of doing it that feels a bit better for you, you know, different format or something.
Yeah, that's the kind of, that would be the dream. I mean, the thing is with it is that you kind of, with each show, I've done something that for me is like, you know, just, I feel like I'm pursuing whatever creative kind of impulse is in me at the time. And it really means a lot to me. And it means a lot to me to get the show as good as possible. And so much of that is in the writing as well. But a lot of it is then in the performance. And yeah, figuring out, like, I can't kid myself and think, oh, you know, let's figure out a way of sorting this out and then you can do another show. Because I know that if I do another stand-up show, I won't be able to half-ass it. It'll have to be something that I really care about and want to go well. And then you're kind of, you're in that dilemma again of like, ah, now, you know, how am I gonna do this in a way that doesn't result in me, you know, thrown a strop. So I don't really have an answer for it. And I'm not, I don't want to pretend like I do at the minute because, yeah, I'm not there yet.
That's okay. Looking back, do you remember anything specific that you've learned over the years that has improved your comedy writing?
The thing about the, yeah, choosing your words is like, I think probably the most important thing when it comes to comedy writing and maybe just writing in general. Just, yeah, just choosing phrases that are funnier. I think I had a thing, I had a routine in that third show about the spoons at Oaxaca and how people steal the spoons from Oaxaca because they're really nice, but Oaxaca have a policy that you can bring the stolen spoon back in January if you like and return it to Oaxaca and they'll give you free tacos. And I think the line I had in it was that, you know, it's a double win for Oaxaca because they get their spoons back and they get to watch the thief eat tacos, which I imagine have been interfered with beyond belief. And interfered with was funnier than saying spat in or jizzed in or whatever. And beyond belief was just a funny phrase at the end. And it was a real big, I think all comics have certain routines of their own that are big, that are like, oh, okay, like, I've got to carry on doing this. Like, because that routine wouldn't have been funny. Because I think before you get to the punchline with that routine, the audience can guess what the punchline is. You know, maybe not 100%, but they're already halfway there. You know, there's a lot of setup because you've got to explain to them the whole spoon scheme at Oaxaca. And then, you know, it's a double win for them. And the audience are already thinking about, it's already when you say they give them the spoons and they give them free tacos, I think the audience are already thinking, I wouldn't want to eat those tacos. So they're already thinking that. And you still need to surprise them with the punchline. And so sometimes it is that thing of like, even if they're ahead of you, you can articulate it better than they've already articulated it in their head. And it surprises them because like, that's a funnier way of phrasing it. And sometimes if you just sum up to a T exactly what they had in their head, the laugh comes from that connection, you know, like, and so you can still surprise them. You can still give them something that they feel connected to. So just choosing the right words, and I guess as well, like just following your impulses when it comes to writing and like, you know, not necessarily having a plan for every single beat and every routine and the structure and the overarching narrative and all that. You don't really need that, but just like following that impulse of, I want to do a show where I say that I'm an undercover cop for the whole show. And not really knowing why, but just going with it. And my last show was about, you know, personal stories from my life. And every bit of me didn't want to do that at the start, but just, I just felt really drawn to it and had to go with that and trust it. And it's only because I've been doing stand-up for 10 years that I kind of did trust that and thought, yeah, I'm just going to go with that because, you know, I've felt this feeling before that tells me this is the right direction to go in. So yeah, I'd say, yeah, that's you know, the technical thing would be choosing the right words, but the creative thing is just following whatever impulse it is you've got, and you don't have to justify it to anyone straight away. You just follow that until it makes sense to you and trust that it will make sense.
Yeah. And looking back at your writing specifically, you know, your stand-up and your books and whatever else, what are you proudest of so far?
I think I am proudest of the stand-up shows that I've filmed. So I filmed 4 stand-up shows in 2017 that went out in 2018, and I filmed my last tour show plus a bonus show 2 years ago that's just come out now, and those are the things I'm proudest of, because not only have I like, I've been able to sit down and, or you know, not sit down and write them, but I've been able to write them and put that effort into them, and I know that I've done the best job I could with that as well. Like I don't stop writing the shows, you know, I kind of continue until the very last gig that I do of it, and I continue trying to make it better and hone it. And it's great to film the last time you ever do it as well, because that's that's when I film it, is the last performance of that show. And so it is as good as that show's ever going to be. And then you get to sit down and edit it as well, which is great. And I don't, you know, I don't plug laughs in and I don't turn laughs up or anything like that. But in the edit, you get to just highlight the performance for the audience at home. I love choosing the right shot that shows that facial expression or shows that physical gag the best. And, you know, I love, like, being able to... That's when I feel like I'm really able to show the audience the show that I had in my head. Once they were finished and I watched them back, I was like, that's exactly how I wanted them to be. So it doesn't matter if the whole world says these were a pile of shit. Like, it's like, art is exactly what I wanted to do.
A huge thank you to James Acaster. Watch his four-part stand-up special, Repertoire, on Netflix now. And you can also buy his latest show, Cold Lasagna Hate Myself 1999, for £10 on Vimeo. Details at jamesacaster.com. Do buy James's books, Classic Scrapes and Perfect Sound Whatever. They're both great, but there is a bit about a porcelain exhibition in Classic Scrapes that made me cry with laughter, so that would be my top pick. They're in my shop on bookshop.org alongside others by guests of the podcast. You'll find that at uk.bookshop.org/shop/in-writing, which I will put in the show notes. And buying from there supports the making of the podcast, and it also supports independent booksellers. Sadly, there's only one more episode this series, but I do hope to make more. If you've been enjoying it, do rate it on whatever podcast app you're using and leave a review, as that bumps it up the algorithm and helps other people to find it. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next week.